And now we are with Peter Gelderloos. Sorry if I don't pronounce your name well. Who before wrote, like a couple of years ago, a book called On Nonviolence, Protect the State. And we was wanted to talk with him about the recent action in Ottawa against the RBC, the firebombing of the branch of the RBC made by the FFC group, was like an anonymous group, who did this action in their communique against the RBC because they are involved in the tar sands and the Olympics. But just after this action was denounced by non-violent, peaceful groups or denouncing this action. And all the time that kind of direct action happened, we find people to denounce them. So I would like appreciate to see what you think about that.
Well, I think the most important thing to recognize is that no struggle is ever going to be homogenous. And the desire to homogenize a struggler, the idea to censor other people's participation in a struggle, should be very suspect. That no one is ever going to be happy with all of the other actions that take place in a struggle, and trying to eliminate the actions that one isn't personally happy with is creates very authoritarian dynamics in these struggles that always divide them and also make them weaker when it comes to repression. So lots of times these denunciations happen on the basis of a fear of repression or a concern about repression, when in fact they're doing part of the job of repression by, on the one hand, isolating people who are supporting more illegal or more radical tactics, and then on the other hand creating a fear effect in the broader community to try to to get people to sort of distance themselves from these kind of things, to be afraid of these kind of things, actions like this aren't something that endanger us the way that, for example, tar sands mining endangers us. So it really makes no sense to be afraid of these kind of actions. But by creating this fear effect, this really plays into the government's war on terror, in which an increasing body of tactics, of types of responses that we have to the things that are always going on, the various forms of exploitation and control being carried out by the state and by capitalism. These are some of the few forms of response that we have. So this shouldn't be frightening to us. But the government is trying to criminalize that increasingly under the rubric of anti-terrorism, and by denouncing other people in the struggle and creating this fear effect, people are really only playing into the war on terror and ensuring that the war on terror will be used increasingly and with increasing effectiveness against all of us. And it may start with the people using more radical tactics, but the pacifists are also digging their own graves as well.
Can you say that the people like involved in a group, activist groups, who are denouncing those kind of actions are serving the police repression?
I think absolutely. We have to understand repression strategically. The purpose of repression is to isolate, and that's exactly what they're doing. They're helping the state isolate people who favor more direct or more illegal tactics. And these are the tactics that generally have always been more effective in creating real change, in actually punishing the system for all these various atrocities that it carries out against us on a continuous basis. And the important thing to recognize is that in all of these struggles, the first instances of these more extreme tactics are never popular. But it takes time for these things to win acceptance. But I think a lot of people have a sort of exaggerated sensitivity to public opinion, perhaps not understanding that the public is something, it's a sort of fictive entity, it's something that's created by the media, so it's never going to be on our side. But that in reality, a great many people, not represented in the television, not represented in the newspapers, are sympathetic and increasingly sympathetic to these kinds of actions, because they see that peaceful protests demanding change from the politicians never gets anything done. It never accomplishes anything. That in fact we need to be the ones to take the power into our own hands to create the changes that we want. And so actually a great many of these people who aren't represented in public opinion sympathize with these kind of things. They sympathize with actions that constitute people actually fighting back.
Maybe my next invitee want to talk about that too.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree with a lot of what Peter was talking about. My name is Gord Hill from the Kwakwaka'wakw Nation on the Pacific Northwest Coast. And yeah, absolutely. I mean, we had similar experiences with Oka in 1990 and Gustafson Lake standoff in 1995, where a lot of people, especially in 95 with Gustafson Lake, a lot of the people were influenced by the heavy media propaganda against the militants in the Sundance camp that was put under siege by the heavily armed RCMP forces. And at that time, a lot of people were, you know, they believed what the state and the police were saying about the resistance. They bought into a lot of the propaganda, the demonization and the criminalization of the of those people. And then afterwards, in the, you know, during the year-long trial, and subsequent to that as well, as these people were moving around in the community expressing, you know, why they had made their arm stand and all that, then you, a lot of people, once they began to realize the extent of the RCMP misinformation, disinformation, they began to sympathize with the resistance. And so that's a good example of, you know, even when your struggler, your campaigner, your movement is so criminalized and demonized, you'll still find considerable public sympathy and support, even if it takes a little bit of time. And another example is the Black Panther Party. Heavily demonized, heavily criminalized by the U.S. government and the police, FBI, and then in the 1970, dozens of Panthers had been killed, all kinds of shootouts, deadly police repression, and you still had high levels of support among the black population for the Black Panther Party.
What that mean, that kind of sentence for you, on nonviolence, protect the state, or pacifism as pathology?
Well, yeah, I see pacifism as arising from a religious doctrine. Gandhi, heavily influenced by Christian pacifism, Tolstoy, Thoreau, and this is remains a part of their modus operandi to this day, and that's why they're so authoritarian and so judgmental and so moralistic in their denunciations and condemnation of the resistance, militant resistance, because they ideologically they want to control the movement. They're middle class reformists. They're influenced by their class self-interest, and which is why they pursue constitutionalism, legalism, reformism, and they do not seek revolutionary or radical social change. And it's actually a mistake to believe that we share the same objectives but just go about it in different ways, because that's not the case at all.
Maybe Peter, you want to add something about that?
I want to point out that if folks are uncomfortable with those kind of tactics, then they should be criticizing by doing it better themselves, and that's precisely what they haven't been able to do. One of the reasons that pacifism is increasingly moribund today is because it's been defeating itself for so long. For example, the anti-war movement in 2003, this movement killed itself. It wasn't killed by repression, and this was one of the few times in all of history in which a movement actually was homogenous in the tactics that it used, and it was a total failure. The government didn't even need to repress it. It was a disaster, and it killed itself. So I think a lot of the reasons that proponents of nonviolence, they run to the media or they play this game of coming down on the side of the police against other people in the struggle, is because they haven't been able to criticize by doing it better themselves. They haven't been able to provide any real examples of creating change or creating powerful struggles using their tactics. So in the last analysis, they're choosing to ally themselves with the state.
What you will answer to people also like Kamenko's Otario, who said this is an isolated action, and that's not a mass movement action?
Well, I think it goes into the diversity of tactics, because we need all these different methods and ways of acting, taking action. You know, they always bring that up. It's got to be a mass movement. But a mass movement, a real mass movement, comprises all these different elements: the saboteurs, the armed resistance, the workers striking, the blockades, the unarmed, you know, basically peaceful protests. All these things. That's what a real mass movement comprises of. I don't think they even know what a mass movement is. They wouldn't even know what a mass movement was if they were a part of it.
You want something to add something about that?
I think. That was put pretty well.
Okay. So, do you want to talk on some other topics about nonviolence, protect the state?
Let's see. Maybe you could give me a more specific question regarding the Canadian context.
How do you want to talk about books that you're like spreading here? Before I go to the book, specifically on the book of Gord?
No, I think you should go to the book of Gord. Yeah.
Okay, so Gord, you're there to present your book, the comic books that you made.
The book of Gord. It's kind of like the book of Eli, but a little bit different. It's 500 years of indigenous resistance. It's a comic book published by Arsenal Pulp Press in Vancouver. And it basically documents, it shows, from the arrival of Christopher Columbus to the colonization of the Americas and various stories of indigenous resistance throughout the centuries and up to, Oka 1990 and Gustafson Lake, Ipperwash 1995. And it's the intent of it is basically to inform and inspire indigenous people and in particular indigenous youth about this history of resistance to counter the colonial mythology that it was all, it was like a peaceful, colonialism, that there was these unfortunate disease epidemics, or that indigenous peoples were completely steamrolled by this superior European civilization. So that's basically what the intent of the book is, and I'm out here doing a small book launch tour, and I'll be going to Gonawagi on June 3rd, and then down into Southern Ontario June 4th, and after that to Hamilton Anarchist Book Fair, Kitchener, Guelph, London, Ontario, and hopefully Ottawa and Kingston, and hopefully more places even.
Can you talk about some fights that you narrate in the book? Okay. Who inspire you particularly?
Well, one of the most inspiring, and probably a lot of people don't know about, is the Mapuche in southern Chile. Were never conquered by the Spanish. They resisted them for 3 centuries, and they were only, subdued with the emergence of the Chilean state. But even to this day, the Mapuche continue to resist, defending their territories. Very militant, strong resistance movement. So that's one that I found was really inspiring. Just learning about it, and also, some of the Plains resistance, Crazy Horse, the Lakota. They delivered one of the most devastating defeats against the U.S. military, the destruction of the 7th Cavalry. The Northwest Coast, a lot of anti-colonial warfare against European trading vessels and Royal Navy gunboats and whatnot against British colonialism. Emergence of the American Indian Movement in 1968, Wounded Knee 1973, the occupation of Wounded Knee, which was the site of a massacre in 1890 by the reformed 7th Cavalry, and the emergence of grassroots indigenous liberation movement at that time, up to Oka in 1990, the armed resistance of the Mohawks, the Ganiyankahaga against the Sûreté du Québec and the Canadian military, and Ipperwash, Gustafson Lake 1995. Those are inspiring stories, examples of resistance that I think our people should be aware of, and it's our duty to maintain this history of resistance.
Yeah, on a communique by warriorpublication.com, Warrior Publication was talking about the importance of the armed struggles or other forms of struggles, unanswered to indigenous environmental network.
Right.
Can you comment about that?
Well, Warrior Publications is an entity that I maintain. It's warriorpublications.com is a website. People can go check that out. There's different news updates and articles. Hopefully we're going to improve the website shortly. But basically it was responding to some of the statements that were coming out condemning the attack against the Royal Bank of Canada in Ottawa. Just kind of countering that, because one thing that's happened in the last 20 years since Oka is that we've had this infiltration of these non-governmental organizations into the indigenous movement. They're trained largely by these middle-class reformist organizers, and this is the what we're seeing now is some indigenous groups are coming out and proclaiming themselves as being non-violent because they're following the path of middle-class reformism that they've been instructed in, and so it's necessary to counter that with a different voice. Our ancestors never followed a pacifist ideology because they used a diversity of tactics, because that's what's effective and that's what's necessary, and they didn't limit themselves to some religious doctrine that was concocted by some middle-class lawyer or a middle-class Baptist preacher, And so this is not something I personally want to see happen, and so I will work to counter that and to encourage and to maintain militant resistance.
Do you think that this nonviolent tactic is also very not tactic but doctrine is very white?
And particularly in North America, where I think is probably the strongest because of the mythology of pacifism, which is based on primarily Martin Luther King and Mahatma Gandhi. And the ironic thing is that these guys were people of color, but they've been appropriated and taken by these white middle-class reformist movements and held up as an example of how to conduct a struggle. But not only that, they are actually supported, promoted, and sanctioned by the state because they want people to believe that nonviolent struggle is successful and victorious somehow. So there's a whole mythology built up around pacifism, and it's based on Gandhi and King. And I would really encourage people to investigate the true history of Gandhi and King, because you will find that those movements that are portrayed as victories for pacifism were actually, any victories that can be ascertained from them, because even that can be debated, but anything that was any success that can be attached to those movements was the result of diversity of tactics.
Yeah, no, so we can think that they pacified their population.
Yeah, and one thing about here in North America, where you already have a pacified population, and they're pacified not through state repression or anything. They're pacified through apathy, hopelessness, and if they break through those, then they're pacified by the pacifist ideology. And these guys try to maintain and gain control of movements, and they're often successful in doing so because they have greater resources, being the middle class that they are, and also because they receive state sanction. So you have, Martin Luther King, national holidays for him. Gandhi recognizes the father of modern India. You got major streets and thoroughfares named after King all through the United States of America because they want people to think that that's the way to go. They don't celebrate Malcolm X. Malcolm X represented the militant resistance, the Black Power movement that arose, followed Malcolm's teachings. The Black Panther Party, which was the most successful revolutionary black youth organization in the United States during the 1960s, which is why it was so violently repressed. Meanwhile, Martin Luther King and the Southern Christian Leadership Conference and all these other middle-class reformist groups at that time receiving millions and millions and millions of dollars from the U.S. federal government being sent into the ghettos to pacify the rebellious population then.
Yeah. And also, I wanted to ask you the question, what do you think that the non-native can do in solidarity with the native? Because the question was asked also about that this action was a non-native action in support of native issues.
Well, one thing that we encourage, and we tried to build up through the anti-Olympic resistance movement over the last 3 years, was to encourage anti-capitalist, anti-colonial resistance, because that ultimately that's what unifies a population living in a capitalist colonial society. So we want to encourage those ideas, and we want to in any colonial situation, the anti-colonial liberation movement must seek to divide the colonial society. And we do that by identifying the system of oppression and exploitation that exists for all the population, not just the indigenous people. So that's why you want to see a militant resistance movement arising, not just within the native peoples, but within the whole society. So you want to encourage all those sectors to engage anti-capitalist, anti-colonial resistance.
So do you want to add something about that? If you want to know more about the perspective of Warrior Publication, we can repeat that warriorpublication.com is the website.
Yeah, warriorpublications.com.
And we can maybe repeat the dates of your book launch tour for the book you just wrote.
June 3rd, I'll be Ganawagi at the library from 1 to 2 p.m. June 4th, I will be in Kitchener. I don't have the specific dates for the times for the rest of these. June 4th, Kitchener. June 5th, Hamilton Anarchist Book Fair. June 6th, possibly Guelph. June 7th, possibly Toronto. June 8th, London, Ontario. And then the dates for Ottawa and Kingston have yet to be arranged. And perhaps there will be other dates set as well.
Thanks.
All right. Thank you. Gilica.